What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Rick Jacobs, president of the Union for Reform Judaism, the largest organization of synagogues in the world. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking lately about what it means to create a truly good community, both in a synagogue and in the larger sense, in a full Jewish community, which, of course, is just like doing it in any community of any religion or other sort of affiliation, only because it's Jewish, it's more so. True community is made up of a group of individual people who are committed to creating and belonging to something larger than themselves. Therapist M. Scott Peck taught us in his wonderful book, The Different Drum, that community building is often a messy, emotional process, and last week I saw some weird and not-so-wonderful examples of just that. My friends, I'm afraid there are some things about human beings living together that will always remain a mystery to me. As a congregational rabbi, and before that a congregational cantor in synagogue settings for the past 35 years, I have watched and participated in Jewish communities actively since Jimmy Carter was president. And I can tell you that there are aspects of the ways we interact that remain spectacularly bizarre to me. Often it seems as though small items become huge flashpoints, while major issues are simply ignored. And just what will trigger conflict can seem positively preposterous. Never was that illustrated more clearly to me than last week, when I found myself dealing with a series of surprisingly angry disputes between basically very good people on subjects that all involved food. Now, knowing how important food is to Jews, our two favorite sports are kvetching and eating, after all, and arguing about food satisfies both of these needs. The subject of these quarrels shouldn't be all that surprising, but the nature of the disputes and the depth of passion displayed was curious indeed. Here's what the three big fights were about last week. First, what kind of wine and symbolic food could be used in an event? Second, who got to make bread for a particular Sabbath service? And third and finally, what kind of lunch a group of volunteers should bring to a class each week? Every one of these conflicts seemed on the surface to be petty. Why should any of these issues have resulted in full-on conflict and the bruised feelings, injured egos, and damaged relationships that they brought? In one sense, these arguments demonstrate that people certainly care very deeply about the specifics of the communities to which they belong. They often care so much that even the type of wine or who gets to make the challah or whether we eat bagels or muffins can become a flashpoint for frustration, even alienation. After all, if you truly value your role in your community, what could be more important to it than what you are going to eat and who takes credit for making it? But in another sense, these arguments are much more closely related to the ways in which we let our egos get the better of our judgment, and they lead us to mistake small matters for much bigger ones. The truth is that we all do this, and not just on matters involving food. It's easy, if you care about your community or your work, to lose perspective, to fail to see that you are being, well, a little bit ridiculous about a particular issue or position that you are standing for on principle. I remember once receiving a postcard from a former confirmation student that showed a picture of the earth with an arrow pointing to a tiny dot on it, and the words, "This is how big your job looks from outer space." It was a helpful restoration of perspective for me, and a good reminder. You know, it's very easy to think that you are more important than you really are in any field of endeavor, and that's true from the president of an organization to the person bringing a side dish for the potluck lunch. So after having had a few days to try to gain perspective on this, all I can conclude is that when we live in community with other people, many of us mistake our transitory personal feelings for some sort of divinely given truth. If we feel it, then God must have ordained it, and we are justified in displaying those feelings in every way, including the worst ways possible. It's good to care about what you're doing, including the food you are preparing, but it is more important to remember that you are part of something greater than yourself, that ultimately your relationships with others need to matter more than your own ego. So, what does Jewish tradition actually say about all of this? Perhaps the most relevant passages are in Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of Our Ancestors. Im ein ani li mi li uchshani latzmi ma'ani v'im lo achshav ematai. If I am not for myself, who will be for me? But if I am only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? That is, I must look out for my own interests and have the pride to care about the work and giving that I do. But if I only care about my role, I am simply being selfish and egotistical. And perhaps most importantly, if you are planning on doing something good in any area, do it now. In other words, it is good to be engaged in community, to do the essential work we need to do to create belonging, mutual support, friendship, and peace. But it's also central to hold on to the idea that what we do is serving a higher purpose than our own need for approval or importance. Well, since all of these challenging arguments last week somehow revolved around food, here's a play-in from Mark Bloom on the subject of kosher cuisine.
I don't want French, Dutch, or German. That won't determine what cures my hunger inside. I want gefilte fish sauce with that awesome crane and some chopped liver sitting on the side. Now be a good fella, pass that mold made of jello with juicy melon inside. Some kosher varnishkis, a knadel or blintz, and lots of carrot simmers on the side. A culture that really loves to eat savors each and every bite. No, the schmaltz go smack right to the heart. Somehow we've survived all right. I want pastrami on rye bread. You heard what I said, and bring me some fine mozzarella. I want gefilte fish sauce with that awesome cream and some chopped liver sitting on the side. Smoke sable fishes, unveil the collar with pride. A bagel schmim with the locks, crepe lock and cabbage borscht with locks and kugel somewhere on the side. Fleischig or milchig, you know what I dig, that salty Nova Sublime. I want a kosher dill, my chicken soup bowl filled, but leave the falafel for me on the side. Sponge cake, moist and sweet. A bishel kamishbroid, now that would be nice. Homemade ragulach, imported halva, dipped in chocolate, ooh, it's worth the price. I don't want pork chops and bacon, that won't awaken my appetite inside. I want gefilte fish sauce with that awesome crane and some chopped liver. Oh, there's not much left. Well, do they deliver? No? Well, I guess then just a sliver. On the side.
That was Mark Bloom playing and singing his parody Kosher Cuisine on this beautiful morning with a little shafafa on the side. Community, And creating it on a grand scale is very much the subject that occupies our special guest this morning here on Too Jewish. Rabbi Rick Jacobs is the president of the Union for Reform Judaism, the umbrella organization of all Reform synagogues in North America, and the largest organization of synagogues in the whole world. He's seeking to carve a new path for the over 100-year-old organization, and we'll find out what it's like to take over the URJ and what he plans for it when we talk with him in a few moments here on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning our guest, Rabbi Rick Jacobs. He's the president of Union for Reform Judaism, the largest synagogue organization in the world, leader of North America's Reform Jews. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
My pleasure. This was not a small job to step into. 2 years into the position, how does it feel?
It feels exciting, it feels challenging, and it feels as if we are at a critical moment for all of us to be thinking and acting differently. So I'm privileged to have this role, and I am excited to have lots and lots of partners.
Reform Judaism is the default statement of many American Jews. You say, what are you? They say, well, I'm a Reform Jew. But most of those people who say that don't actually belong to Reform synagogues. Is there a way to change that? Should that be a goal?
I think, first of all, it's not a negative. I think it's a positive. What it means is that there are people who are not formally connected to our movement who identify with our values, with our commitments, and with our practice of Judaism. We'd always like to move people closer, and we'd like to bring them into the very heart of what we do. But I think that's a great starting point. And we find that also in the state of Israel, that there are plenty of people who are not formally connected to our synagogue or to our Israel movement, but they feel this is the Judaism they identify with.
In the recent Pew study, which everybody has jumped on since it's the most recent national demographic study, many people say that they're not Jewish by religion. What do they mean by that, do you think?
I think they mean many things, and I think it is widely misinterpreted. I think the study of the nones, these are the people who say when you ask them of their religious commitments, they say none of the above. Many of them actually have a belief in God, some kind of spiritual practice, and what they are saying is that they are particularly allergic to the expression of institutional religion in our world.
Yeah, a lot of times I'm told, oh, I don't believe in organized religion. I say, well, come join us. We're Jewish. We're not very well organized. Is that true? Do people just dislike the whole notion of an institutionalized religion?
No, I think they are reacting specifically to the way in which religious institutions have stood for, they will articulate in the Pew study on nones, for money, power, and a partisan political agenda that they do not identify with. So I don't think it's just religion or even, you know, congregational expressions, but that larger message of what religions have been very busy, certainly in North America, promoting, being involved in. And I think that for many young people especially, it is a disconnect and something they do not want to be a part of.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Rick Jacobs, president of Union for Reform Judaism, when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from FlavorArt in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast. Just search 2JewishRadio. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going June 11th to June 23rd of this year, 2014. If you want to go with me on this fantastic journey to Israel, the most amazing country in the world, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to Masada to Jerusalem, please email 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or you can call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. Last week here in America, we celebrated Valentine's Day. That's St. Valentine's Day, a festival basically unknown in Israel. They do have a kind of lover's day called Tu B'Av, which comes in the summer, and it's filled with some of the same shtick we've attached to the late Catholic Saints February festival. But in the spirit of American Valentine's Day, here's Israeli singer Rinat Bar. Her beautiful song, Ahuv Sheli, My Lover, who doesn't know just how much I love him.
Ta iti bevinoti enli od makom balev sheli yeshrak echad enli od chalom bishvili ata haor lachen otar li rak לבחור אתה נושא אותי אל המרור אהוב שלי כל שנייה בליבי אתה לא 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 יודע כמה ואהובי היום שלך בשם
That was Rinat Bar's lovely song, Ahuv Sheli, My Love. We welcome our Mevina in Israel, Oshrat Bar-El, the head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Welcome and Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And Rufua Shlema, you're a little bit sick today, like most of the city. I know what happens when you get sick in America. What happens when you get sick in Israel? How does the healthcare system work?
Okay, so if you are Jewish, and of course, you know, most of them in Israel, yes, so you ask your mother for a marak off, for a chicken soup, but then you're going...
if the Jewish penicillin is not sufficient.
And then if it's not sufficient, so you need to go to one of the three major, you know, companies in Israel, Klalit, Meuchadet, you know, Maccabi. We have three.
Three different major healthcare providers.
Yeah, actually four, but three main. And you need to be registered to one of them. So you will go to the medical center that connected with one of them. You can't go, you can't choose.
You can't cross lines.
Yeah, okay. You can, but it's a process that you need to apply and it right. takes some time. And then you have your, if you are lucky, so your doctor will be at the same time that you need it at a medical center. And actually the services are really cheap. And you can have like an additional medical insurance mm-hmm. that will allow you...
Like what we would call a supplemental medical insurance.
Yeah, yeah. The same companies actually
offer
you...
a higher
you,
level of
you
care.
Don't need to go to other insurance company. The same company will allow you in a very cheap, you know, payment, the monthly payment... Like,
to
like
go to the
to
next
cover
level.
More, you know. Right. And then if you need, chas v'chalila, if you need the trufot, like medicine, it's really cheap. It's like a few dollars per, you know, per antibiotics dosage, right. and, you know, yeah.
It's now, Americans are, I think, terrified of the notion of socialized medicine. Israel's had socialized medicine for a long time. Is it difficult to get in to see your doctor? I mean, do you have to wait a long time?
I guess it's, like a change from place to place, but I can tell you from our city, from Beit Shean, usually, yeah, you give a call and you can see him the same day or the day after, right, if you're still exactly. alive.
If you're still alive. I will say that I've heard that there is a higher percentage of doctors in Israel than anywhere else in the world, higher per capita number of doctors.
Also lawyers.
And lawyers. It sounds so Jewish.
Jewish
too
yeah.
Jewish. I did want to say one thing. I think that doctor salaries are proportionally lower in Israel than they are in the United States. It's a different kind of standard.
Mm-hmm.
But they also work kind of normal hours, I've heard, like 40-hour weeks. They don't necessarily work huge numbers of hours.
Usually the problem is the doctor that just started. So right. and they will work much more hours and will earn less. But when they become more, you know,
established,
yeah. and they will have their own clinic in additional, yeah, they need to work hard in order to, you know, earn like the doctors here that work less.
That's right.
yeah.
Well, Oshrat, feel better soon. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
I've been following, we've been following this story of the French comedian Dudonné Mbala, who's black and white combination, French and Cameroonian, and has now made a name for himself basically with an anti-Semitic kind of neo-fascist gesture and a lot of anti-Zionist propaganda. And it seems very strange. His first partner in comedy was Jewish, and yet now he's an advocate of what seems to us not only anti-Zionism, anti-Israel, but anti-Semitism. How can this be?
Well, it's a complicated question. I mean, he's allied himself with notorious racist figures and neo-Nazi figures like Jean-Marie Le Pen and his daughter. So how does somebody who appears to be African, or at least half African, and who would be the victim of racism, join forces with a self-proclaimed racist? And how does somebody who's the son of an immigrant join forces with an anti-immigration movement? This probably has a lot to do with self-image, self-hatred. I mean, I don't want to psychoanalyze this guy, whom I don't know, have never met, have never heard personally, et cetera, et cetera. But it raises more interesting questions, which is not only in France, but in most of Europe, there's a resurgence of extreme right-wing parties, of neo-fascists or neo-Nazis, and a persistence of anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism, which some scholars and historians say is part of the underlying fabric of Western society and Western values. So, I mean, we tend to label France and Germany as being particular hotbeds of anti-Semitism. I'm not convinced that's true.
As we've discussed at various times on Too Jewish.
Right. I do think that those are both large countries with economies that are uncomfortably dependent on foreign workers who may live there two or three generations but are still considered foreign by virtue not necessarily of their race, like the Turks
in Germany, right.
Are not necessarily visibly different, but they're Muslims, however secular they may be, and some are not particularly secular, some are. Or the Muslims in France, many of whom are from former French colonies in North Africa and not particularly darker or visibly different from the so-called true French people. But I think the economic situations in these countries, as well as the history of anti-Semitism in these countries, has a lot to do with this. And I think we should talk probably next week about a metaphor we've touched on before, which is Jews in society as sort of the canary in the coal mine.
In other words, we know when something's wrong in society because they're coming after the Jews. We will talk more about this next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This one in the spirit of the Winter Olympics. In a slalom race, a skier has to pass through 20 gates as fast as possible. Surprisingly, this year, Israel had Avram, the fastest slalom skier in the world, and great expectations for a Sochi Winter Olympics gold medal. Well, the final came, and the crowd waited in anticipation. The French champion sped down the course in 58 seconds. The Swiss was at 58.7, the German at 60.2, and the Italian at 60.3 seconds. And finally, it was Avram's turn. The crowd waited and waited. And then Avram crossed the line in 3 minutes. "What happened to you?" asked the team coach when Avram finally got through. And he replied, "Which jerk put a mezuzah on each gate?" Yes, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Look, you see, in Jewish tradition, you're supposed to put a mezuzah, a small box with passages in it, on every doorway. And every time you go through the door, you're supposed to stop and kiss the mezuzah. Never mind. When you have to explain jokes. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Vayakhel deals with the question of the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, the consecration of the first central worship sanctuary for the people of Israel. Vayakhel et ha'am, the text has it. Moses assembled the people, called them together, and asked them on God's behalf to bring forward the finest objects they possessed to help create the tabernacle in which the whole people could worship God in holiness. And the people gave of the best they had. Gold and silver, precious stones, and materials used to create a beautiful sanctuary, one they could be proud of, and one which they believed would lend itself to the perpetuation of beauty and sanctity. And then Moses invited those artisans, wise in the ways of working with beautiful items, to come forward and create a structure that embodied what God saw as appropriate for a sanctuary. In particular, Moses explained that God has called by name a man named Bezalel from the tribe of Judah, whom God filled with the Spirit of the Lord in wisdom, understanding, knowledge, and all manner of skilled workmanship. He is filled with the wisdom of the heart, that he might teach and work with every wise-hearted person in this sacred work. When their work was complete, they created a tabernacle that God immediately filled with the divine presence, a place of profound sacredness for our ancestors. I love that phrase for those skilled in the work of the hands. Wise-hearted men and women who create beauty and elegance to serve God in this world. Each of us has different skills. Some sing, some dance, some speak eloquently, and some of us create works of art and practical beauty with our hands. Each of us can contribute to the creation of holiness in this world by applying those skills to sacred work. And when we do, we too have the potential to bring God's presence into our midst, into our ordinary, practical world, and so to make it sacred. May we each use our skills this week to make our lives, and those around us, and our world, a little more holy. In a complex Jewish world, which direction will Reform Judaism go? We asked the man best qualified to answer that, the newish president of the Union for Reform Judaism, Rabbi Rick Jacobs. Find out his answers when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Abe Foxman, the longtime head of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, a past guest of Two Jewish and one of the most respected leaders of the American Jewish community, announced his retirement last week, effective in July of 2015, after 27 years as its national director. President Barack Obama praised Foxman as irreplaceable, adding that for decades, Abe Foxman has been a tireless voice against anti-Semitism and prejudice in all of its forms, always calling us to reject hatred and embrace our common humanity. Founded in 1913 in the wake of the lynching of Leo Frank, the ADL continues to fight anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry and works for civil rights. Abe Foxman has been a forthright and powerful spokesman for the ADL for more than a quarter of a century, and he has long been a particularly effective representative of our people. He will be missed. Well, it looks like the return to close relations between Israel and Turkey is not happening so quickly after all. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan said last week that he demands a written protocol from Israel pledging it will lift the siege of the Gaza Strip as a condition for signing a reconciliation agreement and normalizing relations between the two countries. Erdogan did say that negotiations with Israel have progressed, but they haven't ended. As reported here on Two Jewish last week, Erdogan said that Turkey had received an apology from Israel and talks over compensation for the families of those killed and wounded on the Mavi Marmara ship in 2010 are going well. However, the Turkish Prime Minister said the lifting of the siege over the Strip, which was one of the conditions set by Turkey for normalizing relations, has not yet transpired. Nothing will happen without lifting the siege on Gaza, he said. The response from the office of Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu was swift. Lifting the blockade of Gaza, which has repeatedly stopped ships loaded with rockets, artillery shells, and other weapons from arriving in the Hamas-controlled territory, is out of the question. Earlier in the week, Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu told a local TV station that Israel and Turkey are closer than ever to normalizing relations between the two countries. There has recently been momentum and a new approach in compensation talks, Davutoğlu said. Most of the differences have been recently removed in these discussions. We will continue to follow this story. And in another ongoing story, a second cache of valuable art, looted by the Nazis, was discovered at the Austrian second home of collector Cornelius Gerlitt. Last week, a collection of 60 works by artists like Renoir, Picasso, Toulouse-Lautrec, Lieberman, Monet, and Manet were removed from the Salzburg home to a secret location. Experts are now examining their provenance. Gerlitt said that the Salzburg collection is worth far more than the 1,400 works confiscated from him by German officials nearly 2 years ago in Munich in the course of an investigation for tax evasion. In Germany, a task force is now investigating that collection, and photos of about a third of the works have been displayed on the government-sponsored Lost Art website, trying to find the original owners, most of them likely Jews, who had the art stolen from them by the Nazis. The Austrian collection will remain hidden, according to Gerlitt's attorney, Hannes Hartung, who said that the works would not be shown to the German task force. Gerlitt thanked Austria for agreeing to hold the Salzburg collection in an undisclosed location while the provenance is checked. "We applaud the Austrian authorities for their respect for private property," the lawyer said. Gerlitt has decried the German decision to display works from the Munich collection online in an attempt to discover if any were stolen from Jews or from museums during the Nazi period. He claims it's a violation of his privacy. Gerlitt's father, Hildebrand Gerlitt, was a collector whom the Nazi authorities used to evaluate, buy, and sell works for German museums and for their own personal profit. In the immediate post-war years, U.S. military authorities confiscated the works in Hildebrand Gerlitt's possession, but then released them. His son eventually inherited his collection, which was discovered by the Germans while investigating Gerlitt's potential tax evasion for selling off some of those paintings. And now, an even more valuable collection of Nazi-looted paintings held by this man has been found just after the release of the movie The Monuments Men. A tweet calling for the destruction of Israel cost an Egyptian voiceover artist his job with Walt Disney. He was the voice of the Arabic version of Donald Duck. Sorry. Disney decided, "I am no longer the official voice of Donald Duck in its Middle East dubbed cartoons because of an anti-Zionism tweet," Wael Mansour, a radio personality and voice artist from Cairo, tweeted, adding that he was proud of the punishment. Disney dropped Mansour finally after he had tweeted statements hostile to Israel back in August. "I truly wish Israel is demolished. I hate Zionism. I have so much hate inside me with every single child they murder or land they seize," Mansour tweeted back on August 4th. That was retweeted 950 times. He also told his Twitter followers later, "I don't know why insulting Israel and Zionism is anti-Semitic. They are just a bunch of Polish-Ethiopian immigrants roughly 70 years old." At the time, Disney tried to distance itself from Mansour. A spokesman with the company told the media that Mansour was not a Disney employee, but worked for a dubbing company. Abigail Disney, granddaughter of Roy Disney, who helped his brother Walt found the company, blasted Mansour's statements, describing them as repellent, of course, via her Twitter account. And now he is off the Donald Duck account. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our very special guest, Rabbi Rick Jacob. He's the president of Union for Reform Judaism, the umbrella organization of all Reform congregations in North America, the largest synagogue organization in the world. Rabbi Jacobs,
the Reform movement is in an interesting position. We've seen a lot of change within the URJ itself over the last several years. Where do you see it going?
Well, first of all, the change that we've seen is, I think, the statement of an organization that is looking both inward and outward at the same time. And our movement is literally built on thoughtful change. And given all of the incredible dynamism, opportunity, and even shifts that are going on in the wider culture and within Jewish life in particular, to not change means to go backwards. So I think we are seeing literally a whole different way that congregations are conceiving of their work. I mean, it used to be that congregations kind of sat inside their doors waiting for people to knock on the door. When they did, people would say, oh, come on in. What we're seeing is a Jewish community and a wider religious community where people actually don't have in their DNA this homing device that brings them into congregations. So congregations have to project themselves outside their walls, have to engage people in a much wider variety of not just activities, but of engagement so that, frankly, people will discover what goes on within our movement, what goes on within congregations, and want to be a part of it.
At the recent biennial, you spoke extensively about audacious hospitality, hachnasat orachim, but maybe on steroids, or human growth hormone, perhaps. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu even echoed that theme in talking about Israel. What do you mean by audacious hospitality, and how do you see that as something that Reform congregations, in fact, all Jews, can implement?
Well, first of all, I think it has its biblical origins in that remarkable moment when Abraham is home in his tent recovering from his recent Brit Milah, and he is such a person who practices audacious hospitality that he can't just sit and say, you know what, on another day I'll feel better. He sees literally in the distance three wayfarers making their way through the desert. And what does our Abraham do? He runs after them. They appear to be just three ordinary desert folks. They don't look like they're any people in particular. He cannot stay put. He simply must bring them in and welcome them. I think what audacious hospitality is not just the act of welcoming people in, but the open-heartedness that says they have something critical to share with us. So Abraham's three desert wanderers turn out to be three angels, and they bring with them messages that change Abraham and Sarah's lives. So I think what we do when we practice audacious hospitality, whether it's interfaith families, people who are to this point uninspired by Jewish life, maybe they are young people who don't think synagogues really exist for them, all of those folks who we bring in this act of audacious hospitality, we say, we want to actually learn with you and from you, as opposed to, we want you to come in so we can download everything we think and everything we believe and everything we do. Audacious hospitality says that the folks outside have something really critical to contribute. It changes how we think of those outside versus those inside. And instead of judging them and saying, what's the matter with all these people that don't come, you know, to synagogue, that don't take religion seriously, is to say there potentially are a host of really good reasons why someone has yet to step inside our walls. And we change our attitudes, and therefore we must change our practice. Audacious hospitality is the best way for us to do that.
You know, being in a congregation where we've had 5,000 people take Taste of Judaism, just coming, bringing people in the door, requires going out and asking people to come in. Where do congregations, where do Jewish entities find the resources to do that?
Well, it's a great question, and it assumes that it is enormously expensive to convey those messages. And certainly, you know, in some conventional advertising, it would be. But in the world that we live in, whether it's, you know, with Facebook and other social media strategies,
sure,
right, we have ways to get those messages out there. And I think that we need to be creative because, let's be honest, it's hard to do it. We actually started a new website called reformjudaism.org, which last year had 500,000, visitors.
Discreet visitors, right.
Discreet visitors. The last, you know, months, it's actually been growing. These are people who maybe in, you know, Tucson or in, you know, Toledo, Ohio, who say, I'd like to know, you know, I heard that today is Rosh Chodesh. well, what is that? That seems like a really, kind of a familiar term to some, but not to me. So if you Google Rosh Chodesh, you'll line up, you know, kind of all kinds of sites, including Chabad and probably some other, you know, outreach organizations from the ultra-Orthodox world. But now you'll get ReformJudaism.org, which actually gets our message out to people who are just curious. That helps. We also say in that website, if you'd like to connect to a congregation near to you, just put in your zip code. So someone in Tucson does that, and boom, out pops your congregation. And that can be one of, you know, 20 new strategies for getting the word out there. So I think we want to be using every bit of technology, but we also want to make sure that our individual members and our leaders, that they're connectors, that they're spokespeople, that they'll, you know, meet somebody at work who is curious about Judaism. And by the way, Sam, your numbers may be the lottery numbers. I don't know if I've heard anybody in our almost 900 congregations who has that kind of success. So can I just say I should be asking you to answer that question, and then what I'd like to do is share that answer, not just with your radio listeners, but with all those leaders in our movement. So can I pass that ball back to you and say,
sure,
you ought to be teaching all of us how to do it.
It's very kind
really
of you.
Well.
And I think the key was putting it all into marketing, not taking a salary to do it, just trying to reach out, and then branding it really quickly. But I'm happy to do more of that offline with you. I have two more big questions to ask. But I think really a big part of it was a commitment to it. And when funds dried up one place, finding them somewhere else. It isn't wildly expensive. On a per capita basis, it's been a tremendous feeder for our congregation and for the whole Jewish community, because I think the potential of that particular program, Taste of Judaism, we established the Taste of Judaism 2, we came up with outreach services, and developed a whole outreach program focused around bringing people in the door. And then, you know, dip your toe in the water, put your whole foot in, then maybe you'll walk in all the way.
Fantastic.
You went to the Chabad Kinos Shluchim. Tell us about that experience.
First of all, I was invited by Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky, who is, the key Chabad leader in today's Chabad worldwide organization. I had actually had a meeting in his office prior where I asked him, could we sit together and talk about Jewish life and work that Chabad does, work that we're doing. And out of that came a lot of goodwill, and Rabbi Krinsky invited me to this gathering, which is about 5,000 of the shluchim. These are the Chabad emissaries from all over, you know, the ones from Cambodia and from South America. Literally, it's their big gathering. And so I said I would be honored. I wanted to just get a sense of what really is the, not just the feeling, but what's the kind of work that they do to give these, you know, emissaries their incredible commitment. Rabbi Krinsky sat me down next to him. I was a little bit surprised and very honored. And as everyone came up to greet him, he introduced me as his colleague, Rabbi Rick Jacobs, you know, very honored. I did stand out. I would just point this out. A couple of friends saw it on Facebook and said, Rick, you really stood out. You're the guy without the black fedora. And people were curious. They said, why are you here? I said, I'm here because Chabad does extraordinary work in outreach and in serving the wider Jewish community. And I am always ready to learn from best practitioners. And I also said that my colleague and friend Rabbi Krinsky invited me, and I was honored to accept his hospitality. So it was a real learning experience. We danced, we shared a lot of conversation, and at the end of the day, you know, people said, really, is that what the leader of URJ should be doing? And my feeling is I should be connecting wherever there are opportunities. And we're not going to agree on everything at Chabad. You know, that's true both ways. But there's so many things that we could actually do together to strengthen Jewish life. And I think that's got to be an ongoing commitment for all Jewish leaders today.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about Israel. It's an incredibly exciting time for Reform Judaism in Israel. Explain a little bit about why.
Well, for decades, certainly the non-Orthodox communities in Israel have felt not only disrespected, but excluded in really concrete ways. And for all of us who travel regularly from the diaspora to Israel, there are certain places where that is really brought home. For example, the Western Wall. There's no more sacred place that we could identify as a Jewish people. And yet, when you go to the Western Wall, there's a men's section and a women's section, and Orthodox ritual is the only accepted ritual. And for years, Anat Hoffman, who leads our Israel Religious Action Center, on behalf of the Reform Movement, but also on behalf of the Women of the Wall, has regularly on Rosh Chodesh held services and said, this is not acceptable. Well, a year ago, she was arrested and treated very harshly. And the Jewish world was just, you know, so infuriated. And many of us approached the prime minister and said, this is bad for the Jewish people, it's bad for the state of Israel, and it is wrong. He made a commitment that the Western Wall would become a place where all Jews, and frankly, people of all faiths, would be welcome and have a more pluralistic, egalitarian section. That is now in the final stages of negotiation with the government. Natan Sharansky has been phenomenal. We've worked closely with the conservative movement and with Women of the Wall to negotiate, really, how would that take place? And there's a separate additional section of the Western Wall, which the commitment from the government is that will become a place where we can pray men and women together with a guitar using liturgy that we not only use but find incredibly edifying and spiritually uplifting, and that it would also create a place for Israelis who don't identify with Orthodoxy. And by the way, Orthodoxy is a beautiful expression of Judaism. It, however, is not the only one, or it is not the privileged, most authentic, though it is often presented that way. This is unheard of in the history of Israel, and it's extraordinarily exciting. Our movement has been right there helping to lead, and I know that we're working in concert with others who are fighting for religious pluralism, for the freedom to marry, to have a Reform rabbi or a conservative rabbi officiate at your wedding and have it be respected and recorded by the state of Israel. Currently, that is not the case. Israel is the homeland of the Jewish people. It must be the place where we can out loud and with, you know, pride and with acceptance live non-Orthodox Jewish lives. And I don't think it's going to happen all in one symbolic move, but what's happening at the Kotel is going to be symbolic of what will happen throughout Israeli society. And I'm excited and, frankly, quite encouraged by the partnership of the Israeli government and of the Jewish agency led by Natan Sharansky and by, you know, many, many people within the wider society who say, Higi Azman, time has come, it's long overdue, and let's celebrate this wonderful shift.
Rick, I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish. As a fellow native Southern Californian, I have to ask you, you talked about surfing at the biennial. Do you ever get a chance to surf anymore?
It is such a hope and a dream. I actually have windsurfed in the last couple of years, but there are things that you kind of want to be a little bit more careful about. I think that surfing is better in your teens and 20s. Windsurfing is okay as you get older, but I love the ocean and look forward to every chance I can to get to Southern California and also to see those photos of the days when I was out there riding the big
on the board.
Yeah.
I want to thank you again for a great visit. Maybe you'll get out to Arizona as well, and we look forward to speaking.
Would be a privilege. Thank you.
You're very welcome. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in Southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Rabbi Eric Yaffe, the immediate past president of the Union for Reform Judaism, and the 2014 Rabbi Albert T. Bilgrey Scholar in Residence at Temple Emmanuel next weekend, exploring Judaism in America and Israel today. Our play out this morning comes from Avanim, our house rock band, a tune written by my dad, Rabbi Baruch Kohan, to the classic rabbinic text, Shalom Rav Le'ohavei Toratecha, great peace of those who love the Torah. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
Shalom Rav Le'ohavei Toratecha. Shalom Rav. Shalom Rav Ve'eim Amo. Ve'eim Amo. Mitzvot Kehi Shalom Shalom Kehi Shalom Bechele Shalva 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 Be'olim Notari Be'man Lachai Be'rei'ai Adabra Shalom Shalom Ba Shalom Rav Le'ohavei Toratecha.